Shaw. This is The Conversation. Welcome and thank you for being here. It's the Samantha Fields episode. Topics of conversation include airbrushing, etiquette, and art school, to make it relatively alliterative. Samantha Fields, in addition to being a painter, has been a longtime professor at Cal State Northridge. Hello to you Northridge students. So you will be hearing a lot about that, among other things. A lot of talk about airbrush. So if you are curious, good place to jump in. Have a few things to talk about before we get there, though. And one of them, which is very exciting, is coming up. This is Tuesday. You may be listening Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, or later. But coming up this Sunday, June 1st, 2014, The Conversation will be making its debut on K-Chung Radio. We're going to be doing it live this go-round and perhaps in the future. I'm going to be joined by co-host Margie Schnibbe. And as far as I know, we have confirmed to join us Carl Handel, a long time ago guest on The Conversation and a current and recent participant in the Whitney Biennial. So I think it should be interesting. So if you want to tune into that, go to kchungradio.org and click on the live streaming link, and you can listen at 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. on Sunday, June 1st. Before we get to the Samantha Fields, I also wanted to remind you that I am inviting you listeners to contribute to our new segment, which is called Don't Call Us, We'll Call You. And the reason I want you to participate is because it's an opportunity to share some of your obstacles and challenges, things that we all go through. And I know that there's probably a lot of resistance out there to exposing yourself, especially in the art world, where you always have to be on your best behavior and on your best game. But I'm offering the opportunity to do it anonymous. You can send an email and I will share your anecdote anonymously. Let me also just clarify that one of my favorite podcasts, they talk almost exclusively about people's challenges. It's a sort of a mental illness themed show. And so that is its subject. And our subject is not that, but you know, as artists and art writers and curators and art types, we all have our struggles in the art world and out. And, you know, it's nice to hear people's championships and successes. And we have plenty of those here, but I want to throw some struggles into the mix. So you can contribute your Don't Call Us, We'll Call You in a couple of ways. Again, it's the email version where, again, if you ask me, I will share your anecdote completely anonymously. And that email is theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. The phone number, if you want to leave a message and have that played, is 424-256-6618. That's 424-256-6618. I'll mention it later on in case you didn't get a chance to write it down. And yeah, I really look forward to hearing your story. So let's start contributing. Even if you're Cal State Northridge students, go ahead. Shoot an email. Leave a message. Let's show these folks who aren't sharing their anecdotes what it's all about, okay? I should let you know that our sponsor for this episode is Made with Color at madewithcolor.com, which is a DIY web building platform specially designed for artists and artist adjacent types. And if you enter in the discount code conversation, all lowercase, you will get 29% off your first year of service. Let me also mention that you can also support the show a few ways. When you go to theconversationpod.com, you can contribute financially, which is very much appreciated. And we're always on the hunt for a little extra change to support the large structure that keeps this show going. You can also support the show in the social media fashion by becoming a fan on Facebook or Twitter. And you can go to iTunes and write a nice review, bringing more people to the show, which, as I always say, something that I'm always trying to do, grow the audience. And you can also contribute your Don't Call Us, We'll Call You. That's another way you can help. So my co-host today with Samantha Fields is, for the second time, Lindsay Preston Zappas, an artist and an art writer with a art magazine website, an online magazine called Carrots and Sticks. That's C-A-R-E-T-S and sticks.com. And finally, before we get to the beginning of the conversation, I wanted to clarify that at 21 seconds in, it's going to sound a bit like a non sequitur. That's just because I moved the intro section, which ended up coming later, to the beginning. We had started recording mid-conversation, and I didn't want you to miss that. So that's why it sounds like it does, but it'll make sense quickly. All right, here we go. This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw, and I'm joined by Lindsay Preston Zappas once again, second time.
Second time. Hey, Michael.
And our guest today is Samantha Fields.
Hello.
AKA Sam.
Yes.
Only by friends, or how does that work?
Everybody except for people who are writing me a check. Those people are Samantha. You know, when I was in school, there were certain topics that were taboo, right? Like, you don't talk about the business of art. You don't talk about gallery relationships. You don't talk about how you talk to a dealer. You
right.
don't talk about any of that stuff, like studio visits. It was this mystery, right?
Your
teachers did it. You thought you were going to do it, but nobody ever taught you how to do that. And so it's a lot of trial and error for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the class that I teach is a new class that I just wrote with a colleague that deals with that, those kind of meta issues in not just like the ins and out of the business practice of an artist, but also just how to be. Like, mm-hmm. the thing I really liked in your Lizzie Pose talk was networking and like what that means, that it's not just give me something, like that people approach networking like, what can you do for me? And that's kind of an undercurrent of it, right? But
Sure. What
I've been trying to tell my students is you have to find that mutual thing that you both have in common. Like when you're talking to someone and it's like collaborations arise naturally because mm-hmm. you're talking, you're like, oh, I'm interested in that too. Oh, you know, and then it something magical happens, right? But it's about like going out and putting yourself in real world situations and talking to people. And instead of sending emails, I want to work for you. I want to do this thing. I want this from you. And I think maybe it's because of social media, like there's a real one-sidedness to the way they approach it.
Yeah.
So it's stuff like that, but like they don't know how to price their work. They don't know how market values are derived. They don't know how to ask for a studio visit. And, you know, the answer to that question is, you say, would you like to come to my studio? You know, it's not
well,
rocket
actually,
science.
But I find that actually can be much more complicated because of the reasons that Lizzie and I talked about, you know.
Yeah.
Like, where hierarchically are you in relation to this person mm-hmm. that you're asking for a studio visit? Mm-hmm. What do they know of you? Who do they know you as?
Right.
All these kinds of mm-hmm. things.
And I cover all that stuff too, like knowing. I do a big section on knowing your audience. Who are you talking to? Like, you know, you're an emerging artist right out of grad school. You don't walk into a big blue chip gallery.
Right.
You know, or you're a figurative artist. You don't walk into like the, you know, post painterly abstraction specialist and ask for a studio visit. So a lot of time is spent just getting them to do that. And I'm always a little bit shocked by how seldom students go out and look at what's happening actually right here. Like, I have to kind of make them do that. And I grew up in Ohio, so when we wanted to see art, we would drive to New York and we would drive to Chicago just to look at art. So,
well, a lot of these students are in the Valley.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So going over the Sepulveda Pass is like going to another state, right?
It's another world.
As someone who's not a native Angeleno, I don't get it. I really have to say. Like, I drove across states to go look at art. So when they don't want to drive over a very small mountain, I find that really confusing.
So most of your students grew up in L.A.?
A lot of them. Although I have to say, like, my advanced students, they're pretty adventurous. This is the upside of that, though, because it sounds like they're terrible, and they're not. They're wonderful. Once they start looking, and once I get them seeing what's happening,
they're sold.
They're set.
Yeah.
They can't get enough of it. They go to everything. They see everything. So it's kind of like getting that ball rolling where...
Yeah.
But I think Honestly, a lot of the problem is they're really intimidating. Like, most of my students are working class. You know, their parents didn't go to college. They're, you know, an art, you know, the art market and the art world is a very, you know, it's elitist in many ways. And so they're afraid to go into the galleries. They're afraid of the person behind
and
the
And some of those galleries kind of want you to be afraid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And some more than others. I always tell them, usually the person behind the desk is a graduate student.
Yeah.
And they have no power, so you shouldn't be afraid of these people. You know, like, most of the time, the person who does have power is not the person at the desk. Although that's not always true either. But
right.
I mean, most people are pretty nice, though. I mean, it's in the world. Once they go out and they start talking to people, they realize that, oh, people are generally pretty kind. And we'll talk to you if they're not busy. People will pull things out and show you things. And,
right.
Sure.
Yeah, so, you know, once they get rolling, they're thrilled that they live in Los Angeles. Because I'm constantly telling them, you are the luckiest students in the world.
Yeah.
You have no idea how lucky
there's
you are.
So
everything
much.
You right. could possibly want to see is here.
Mm-hmm.
So...
I'm in a Los Angeles honeymoon phase with art. I mean, it's growing up in San Diego and then living in Detroit is like...
Yeah, but I like that phrase, the Los Angeles
it
honeymoon.
It is,
it's real.
And also, like we were talking earlier about the freeways. I'll go on any freeway. I'll just drive anywhere.
And it's now the art's everywhere. When I moved here, Chinatown was just getting rolling. I came to Los Angeles because I got the job at Northridge. So I won this professional...
Right out of grad school?
Right out of grad school. And it's kind of a weird story, and I tell people they can't emulate my career path because it's freakish.
Don't try this at
all. Don't try to compare yourself to this because it's a freak. It's like winning the lottery.
Sure.
I applied for the College Art Association Professional Development Fellowship. I was 26, and I won it. And I had applied for a gazillion things, and I never won anything.
Right.
So when they called me, I thought it was a wrong number. I didn't call them back. They
like,
kept
who is this?
I was like, that could possibly be for me.
Right.
And finally, they caught me at home, and I answered, and lo and behold, I won this fellowship. So it was a fellowship that helps support people from diverse backgrounds going into academia. And so I applied under a low-income, financially disadvantaged point of view, which I was. And so I got it.
So what about financially disadvantaged? What was the specifics on
just
that?
Just growing up without a ton of money. You know, my dad was laid off. It was the Reagan years. My dad's a locomotive engineer, retired now. So he was laid off for most of the 80s. My mom worked on an assembly line in a factory. And so, you know, it was a rough time. Like, the 80s, if you weren't rich, the 80s kind of sucked. Like, everybody talks about the 80s, like, yeah, the 80s were awesome. Like, oh, we were eating government cheese in the 80s.
So. Right.
Well, was the house that you were in, I'm presuming it's a house, subsidized by the better years of your father than sort of trying to struggle through?
Yeah, they bought the house before, like, the 80s dip, before, you know, the recession. But we ended up losing the house eventually. But, you know, so I came from a place where I'm working class family, working class parents, and, you know, College Art Association was really interested in getting people from minority backgrounds, from LGBT plus backgrounds, and from financially disadvantaged backgrounds into academia to kind of broaden the discourse, you know, because college was always something that's very accessible to people of a certain strata, right?
Sure.
But not to others. So I won. I was shocked that I won. I can't believe that I won. And so
I'm
I got
still
it.
Shocked.
I'm still a little shocked. Yeah, it's been 20 years and I'm still amazed.
How do you think, I mean, without analyzing it too heavily, but representing the financially challenged or disadvantaged, how do you think sort of then and through the years and now that manifests in you? You know, is that something that somebody would be able to see or?
No.
You know what I mean?
Even
it's very abstract, right?
Yeah, I don't even think people could see it when they met me. I don't think there was any way. I mean, despite the fact that, you know, we struggled financially, my parents were really, you know, my mom taught me to read when I was in kindergarten. Like, I could read books. In third grade, I read all the Tolkien books in third grade.
Oh, wow.
I read my first George Orwell book in fourth grade. So I was, you know.
So you were a little smarty pants.
I was a little
smarty pants.
And I got kind of harassed a lot for that. So it was never.
Did you wear glasses?
You're bringing up old
I did
wins,
not.
Michael.
Not till I got. Not till painting ruined my eyes. That's when I got glasses.
Sure.
But yeah. So I was like a little dorky kid. I had asthma too. So add that to the equation. It's like I'm smart. I'm skinny. I have asthma,
combo.
And I had the wrong pants because we were poor. So, like the Wranglers that took like 10 years to break in.
Right.
The JCPenney's.
Yeah.
Bought on layaway. And but my parents were awesome. Like they totally encourage me to be an artist. And they didn't exactly know what that meant.
Yeah.
You know, or what that would turn into.
See, that, so that, I think that's really the sort of the rare quotient that you had. Because, I mean, it's hard to put a percentage on, but I'm guessing, you know, 7 or 8 out of 10 parents would be like, no, you need to get a job that, you know, supports you.
I mean, I think that's true with any background, though. Any kind of financial situation. And
well, we're talking about going into art, right?
Yeah.
Specifically?
Right, yeah. I think coming from a wealthier family could have just even more pressures with those kind of...
I'm pretty sure parents everywhere don't want their kids to go into art.
I think that's a shared...
Yeah, right. They don't want it.
All and, art, yeah.
But my parents weren't just... I was good at it. They loved that I did it. My mom bought me books. She took me to the library. And I never wanted for anything intellectually or supportively. Like, my parents were really supportive. So I always feel like, well, money's easy. Like, the stuff that I had's the hard part, right? That's the stuff nobody has. So I feel really lucky, you know? So I was able to get this fellowship, and the fellowship helped support a teaching position. So I was able to give a lecture at the College Art Association conference on my work.
Oh, wow.
Which I prepared for a lot. God. Like, hours and hours and hours.
So this is straight after Cranbrook?
It was while I was still a student.
Okay.
So I won it. You had to win in your second year of graduate study.
Right.
And you had to have 1 year left. Okay. And the then chair of the art department at Northridge, Joe Lewis, who's now the dean at Irvine, UC Irvine, he was in the audience. And he came up to me after the lecture, and he's like, would you like to come to Los Angeles? And I had never considered Los Angeles. It was not on my radar. I was going to New York like everybody else.
Sure.
You know, I wasn't, it was not even something I considered. And I thought, wow, maybe I should do that, you know? And I did. I just took the chance, and a lot of people tried to talk me out of it.
Yeah.
And it ended up being the best decision I ever made in my life. Of course, when I first got to Northridge, they were still in earthquake recovery, so I taught in a double-wide trailer that had housed hogs at some point.
Wow.
So when it rained, it was smelly. We had no sink, no ventilation. I had to make the students go outside every 20 minutes so they didn't get terpy.
Get fresh air.
Yeah. So it was a really interesting period because we built a new building and I got to be there as we rebuilt the program. So I got to have a voice in how the program was restructured. And, you know, it would initially seem like maybe not such a great idea. Like, I saw the department. I was like, oh, God, I blew my fellowship on this. Why did I come here?
Oh, right.
They don't even have a building, you know. And then it ended up really working out. Like, I'm so happy there. And I work with great people, and I know a lot of people in academia, and there are horror stories of just infighting and backstabbing and, you know, all the academic, you know, the politics in academia are so vitriolic because the stakes are so low, as they say, and so there's a lot of fighting. But I'm in a good place, so I've stayed for some
years. So there are advantages to going over the mountain.
You should go over.
Everybody's nice over there.
Yeah, you should go over the mountain. So
yeah, we should venture on that side of the mountain.
So I freakishly got this job when I was 26. I mean, I was a baby.
Yeah.
People didn't know that I was a teacher. Like, it was a constant negotiation of authority trying to, like, run classes when I was so young. But it was this bizarre opportunity that I got, and I just ran with it. So, you know.
Wow. That's amazing.
I knew. I was the kid making homework for the other kids and sending them home and be like, bring that back, I'll grade it. Yeah, so I knew, like, this was what I was going to do from a young age.
So you use an airbrush in your painting, and I've used airbrush quite a bit as well, not currently. But the thing that I wanted to start asking you about is there are actually, I don't know what the status of all of them is currently, but there are a number of really skilled painters using airbrush that are actually in LA. And I don't know if that's a coincidence or makes sense, but in any case, one of them I actually had a conversation with, not directly asking about what his technique was, but rather whether it was something that he talked with his students about. And he said, no way, I don't tell them, you know. And so there's this subtext that he had to learn his various tricks the hard way. And it's like, you know, you don't just give that away. So my question is for you, what are your thoughts about the proprietariness specifically of airbrush, but, you know, generally any other kind of skill that an artist uses?
It is so funny that you asked that, because last night I did an airbrush demo for my students. And I unpacked them today. I packed them all up, and I have six different airbrushes. So I took them all up there and showed them how they worked and let them play with them and try them out. Because my thoughts on that, and I'm aware a lot of people are using it now. It wasn't always that way, and it was very devalued. Like, initially working with it, the idea was, oh, don't say it's an airbrush. Say it's acrylic on whatever, which I think is silly. I think however you make the piece, you make the piece. The piece is a piece, right? And
a lot of sort of kitschy, you know.
Right. It has that history.
Fantasy sort of imagery.
The connection. Dolphin with the palm tree, you know. Velvet coaster.
Yeah. Well, my thing when I was a kid, and I was like, that is so cool. When I saw like one of those vans with like the fantasy castle on the side, that was like it.
I mean, I still think that's it.
I was just going to say.
If it has one, email me.
I think deep down, people love it.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
They don't want to admit it.
Right.
So I'm fine with so-called devalued ways of working. So the airbrush is for fingernails or fake abs being body contouring, Hollywood makeup, whatever. I embrace all of that. Mm-hmm. Because it's not the tool, it's what you do with the tool, right?
Yeah.
So my feelings on the proprietariness of airbrush or technique, I teach them how to oil paint. I teach them how to use acrylic. I teach them how to use watercolor. Like, why wouldn't you teach them how to use this? Like, what's the difference? You know, it's just a tool.
Yeah.
I guess sometimes artists are afraid that if they show people how they make things, that someone might make that thing too. But my feeling on that is nobody can make my paintings except for
me.
Exactly. Like, that's absurd to think.
Yeah. Even if they tried to airbrush one of your exact, like, copies of one of your paintings, I think it would have inevitably have a different feel to it.
Right.
Coming from a different hand.
And I do everything wrong. So, because nobody taught me how to do it. I mean, it's true. No one taught me.
Well, there is no right way, though, is there?
Right. Well, apparently there are some right ways, because the guys at the airbrush store constantly are like, what are you doing to these brushes? Like, what are you putting through them?
But I think that's artists in general. Yeah. It's like the artist at Home Depot, the artist at, you know, the car store.
Yeah. I read your article about that.
Yeah.
Of being, like, slightly displaced
all
the time.
And you're, like, sitting in the aisle looking at all these weird-ass
tools. Do you care to elaborate
tools?
So people know what you're referring to?
Oh, I don't want to get too much into it, but there's a meme floating around. You know memes?
Yeah,
like, sure. I barely know what a meme is. But there's one floating around where it's perceptions of you in a certain occupation. And there was one about artists. So it's like what people think of you, what your parents think of you, what you think of yourself as an artist and these perceptions. And that kind of snowballed into talking about all these kind of bizarre scenarios that artists find themselves in. And then the perception of the public, of you as the artist in these situations, Home Depot being one of those that I think every artist has experienced in Home Depot, and the guy is asking you if you need help remodeling your kitchen counter, and you're not doing that, and there's a whole kind of crisis that unfolds.
So you're like looking around for somebody that actually
make sense?
Can help
you. Know,
you?
You've been there.
Yeah.
Everyone knows.
Yeah, I just go straight for the tape, and that's it.
Yeah, nobody understands what you're doing. And the place where I go for my airbrushes, I go to Coast Airbrush.
In Anaheim, right?
I'm sure you're familiar.
I've been there.
So it's this very...
Look at you, too.
It's this very, like, custom culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Cars. You know, and those guys know everything about airbrushes, and they're nice. But I'm an anomaly. Like, I know they're thinking, like, what is she doing? Nails? Mm-hmm, like, she buys these really high-end brushes. What is she doing? And I feel that.
You just have a nail business? You're using that much paint on nails?
I mean, I'm sure they don't know what to make of me, you know? Because I don't fit the you know. But
do you actually talk to them about tricks and, you know, issues?
Never. And that's the funny thing, because I teach my students how to use the airbrush, but I don't teach technique. I don't like teaching technique. I teach technique in my beginning class. But after that, you know, I kind of show them the mechanics of things, and then I let them riff on it themselves.
Right. So this is how you hold the gun. This is what you press.
Yeah. Here's just what goes basic, in basic, it. Basic. Here's how you clean it.
Right.
Here's the compressor. Here's the PSI. So it's all that. And that's plenty. I mean, that's a ton of information, right? It's complicated.
It's complicated.
And then I'm kind of like, invent for yourself how you're going to use it from there. Because I don't use any sort of technique. I mean, I don't know what that even really means.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I make the brush do what I want it to do. Mm-hmm. So if I need something, I figure out how to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Isn't that what painters do?
That sounds like a lot of trial and error.
A ton. Yes. I like to experiment. I like to play.
Michael, did someone teach you how to airbrush?
No, I had to learn myself.
Okay, so right. Familiar.
Did you trial and error as well?
Yeah, but I mean, I ran into a lot of dead ends, you know, where I was like, what am I doing wrong, you know? So it's like, talk to the guy Golden.
Okay.
Et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, yeah, it's just, I mean, but I felt like I was seeing things out there where I was like, oh, I want to know how that happens.
Yeah. I love science fiction. Mm. Love. I'm a total sci-fi dork. Big, big.
Right.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is my new boyfriend.
Right.
Well, he's everybody's hero these days.
Yeah.
But anyway.
He's everybody's boyfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Christian Tedeschi actually turned me onto the podcast quite a while back. So
he told us about it.
I'm sure he did. And yeah, so we're all friends, you know, and we always like watch this International Space Station. It just went over a couple nights ago.
Right.
So, you know, I'm into all of that stuff. And so I kind of embrace the sci-fi airbrushed backdrops, you know, all that stuff. Like, to me, that's something not to be denied in the medium. That's something that's great about the medium. Mm-hmm. So, like, the idea of high-low is...
Right.
Yeah, you know, right. Like, I'm sure you encountered that with the airbrush, too. It's like, people are like, oh, it's this cheesy tool. And I'm like, well, maybe I'm a cheesy girl.
Well, yeah, there's, I think in certain contexts, there is that cheesy tool element. But in others, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, you know. There's another person who's like high-end airbrushing because it's kind of transformed in recent years.
Yeah, right.
By in certain artist hands, mostly in California.
Yeah, and I push really thick paint through it.
Mm.
You know, my paintings are dense. You know, they don't have that lightness that airbrush paintings. Like when you see like the typical airbrush painting, it's kind of one layer.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's like a dark, a mid-tone, and then the little the white blingies. What do they call those in industrial design where you put the highlight with the star?
Oh, like the outer glow.
Yeah, there's actually a name for that. I can't remember.
Like a lens flare? No.
Yeah. It's like a little sparkle.
Yeah.
That's added.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's like those three basic layers of an airbrush painting or a t-shirt or something, you know? So, but my paintings have like 300 layers of paint.
Wow. Yeah.
So they're completely not that at all. So you're looking through, right, all these layers. So it's atypical. A lot of people don't know that they're airbrush paintings when they see them. That's the weird thing to me. So people see them and they think they're photographs. A lot of times people are like, oh, well, it's a photograph. No, it's a painting. And then they think I mounted a photograph and then I painted on top of the photograph. People have all these kind of weird ideas about what the paintings are. And I'm like, no, they're just paintings. I don't make a drawing. I don't do a projection. I don't do anything. All I do is paint. Literally. Canvas, airbrush, paint.
Me.
That's it. There's nothing else. There's nothing.
So you're getting these layers of misperception, basically, from the people seeing these paintings, let alone the fact that it's airbrush and, like, maybe it's kitschy in some way is not even on the radar.
No.
It's just like, wait, what is this?
What is this thing I'm looking at? And what's interesting about them in the relationship to photography is that they look photographic from a distance, but when you come up to them, they fall apart. So there's this kind of clarity, unclarity kind of thing.
Because
they're very misty, you know?
Yeah.
And part of the reason I really like the airbrush is because, you know, some of my earlier work, the storm paintings and the fire paintings, you know, they're these very kind of romantic landscape tropes, right? Like they go back to Turner and the Hudson River School and all that kind of stuff. And if they were made in oil, I think the romanticism of it would be so foregrounded, you know, the tactility of the paint, the lushness of the oil.
Right.
That
such a it's romantic
like,
medium.
Yeah, like how much ground am I going to retread, right, from a painting point of view? So what I liked about the airbrush and a big part of why I use it is because it creates a distance, kind of an intellectual distance between me and the painting. There's a kind of coldness to it. I never touch the painting with my own hands. Like I make this entire painting without touching it. I paint atmosphere with atmosphere, so it's a mist, painting misty things. So there's all these kind of conceptual frameworks around the airbrush that are not cheesy at all, that are the reason that I use it. So I like that there's still these very romantic paintings, but they're romantic without this kind of history of painting being heaped on top of that rose. So it's not like romantic on romantic.
Yeah.
Well, what was the genesis for its use?
When I started using the airbrush, I was actually making really old work, which I'm not sure if you've ever seen, because it was in a pre-digital world, right? So I was doing these kind of animal paintings that were these kind of deformed animal paintings.
Ooh, with the airbrush.
Yeah, well, they initially started as collage, because when I was at Cranbrook, I was doing a lot of collage. So there were a lot of kind of cut collage kind of things. Mm-hmm. And then I was rendering them in oil. So I was doing these really, like, tedious gradations to mm-hmm. make them look dimensional, but I wanted them to have this kind of, and this was around the time of Superflat and when all of that was happening, I wanted them to have this kind of Disney-esque kind of anime, kind of cartoony feel, but they were really horrific. Mm-hmm. So I like this idea of like, in the future, I was interested in genetic modification and kind of playing God and, you know, these kind of big life and death themes, dystopic themes, which I'm still interested in a much different way.
Because you're a sci-fi geek.
Yeah. So now it's landscape. It used to be the freaky animals. Right. And, so I was interested in this idea of like, what if when the world's gone mad, when it's, you know, if you've read Margaret Atwood's Orange and Crake, have you read that? She's one of my favorite authors. Anyway, there's all these genetically mutated animals. They take over and the world runs amok. But what if Disney was still making movies?
Right. So I wanted and the animals to respond to that culture.
Yeah. So they were kind of cute and horrible. They had like tumors and big vaginas and like they were like sexual and weird and
wow.
And so I started using the airbrush because I like the idea that they were these really imperfect creatures, but I wanted them to be perfect.
But the finish was perfect.
Yeah. So the airbrush. The reason I started using it because the airbrush is a corrective. It's a corrective tool. Hmm. Now we say people are Photoshopped in magazines, but we used to say they're airbrushed.
Right.
Yeah. So I like this idea of like I was airbrushing them into perfection. I was like smoothing their flaws and I was like creating these kind of really seamless things. And I was also looking at natural history dioramas and things like that. And those are those, you know, like the sci-fi backdrop paintings and stuff. So there were a lot of reasons the airbrush came into it.
But but I'm curious, though, where specifically the idea came. I mean, was it just sort of a general cultural reference that you grabbed onto or was there?
Yeah, it was just kind of this thing where I was looking at the paintings and I think this comes from the Cranbrook training, too, because it was like I was trying to make these really smooth oil paintings, which is really difficult.
Yeah.
Especially living downtown because there's a lot of grit. And I had tweezers and I was like picking hair out of them.
Too much dirt getting in there.
Yeah, and then the loft would get really hot because it's Los Angeles. So oil paint dries a lot faster here than it does back east. Like back east, you can render for several days. Here you can render for like 6 hours before it gets tacky. So I was running into all these technical problems. And I remember like one thing that constantly came up in critique when I was in school is like, why force one medium to do what another medium can do easier.
Oh, so you're already pointing in that direction, in a sense.
Yeah, so I was making smooth paintings already. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to do things with latex and, like, high-gloss acrylic, and I was trying to find ways to make this really flat, kind of cartoony, like, animate. I was using animation gels, because I was looking at Disney and animation and stuff like that, so I tried using those tools, and nothing gave me what I wanted, and finally, I was like, well, you know, I bet an airbrush would work. And I did not want
to
use it.
So this is after you came to L.A. with
an airbrush. This was in L.A.,
Do you think that has something to do with it? Because it seems like there's a sort of fetish finish, car culture.
Totally. It fit in here. That was the thing. Like, when I started doing it, people responded.
Or even the kitschiness of it seems.
That's when my work took off. Like, when I started, people got it. It was like this super flat, super clean L.A. aesthetic.
Right.
And I'm sure that was rubbing off on me.
Yeah.
You know, looking at people like Larry Pittman and like John McCracken and all this incredible work, graphic work coming out of Los Angeles and really glossy work coming out of Los Angeles. But I didn't want to use the airbrush and I was really terrified and I thought, this is terrible. It's going to clog and it's mechanical and I have to buy a compressor. And
all these parts.
So I was telling my students last night, they're like, how did you figure this out? I'm like, well, I just went and bought one, right? I just went to Pearl Paint, bought like a kit in a box.
Yeah.
Starter kit. With the dumb
compressor that burns out after like 3 weeks. Yeah. Like, yeah, I got that. And so I didn't even quite realize how much particulate matter moves. So I didn't have a spray booth or anything. So I just painted and I had a respirator on, but it didn't occur to me that it was airborne.
Okay.
I mean, I knew intellectually, but I guess the reality of just how airborne it was didn't hit me until I saw that my cat's fur was like a little pink.
Oh.
I was like horrified that I was like, oh my God.
Little outer glow on the cat's
body. And then
body.
I noticed like a couple hours after I painted, like everything was covered in pink. And I thought, oh, this is horrible.
And this is your downtown LA
My downtown loft.
Okay.
So I built a little plastic hut.
Right.
And I painted in that for a while. And then Andre built me a spray booth. Mm-hmm. And then I had a proper spray booth after that. I kind of wised up.
Did your cat survive very long after that?
She did. I gave her a bath immediately before she could start cleaning herself. Because it was fluorescent pink. I'm sure she shouldn't have eaten it. But it was like learning to build a spray booth, learning how to do the intake air, learning how to, like the first fan I put in to vent, I put into like a really good industrial fan, but it was so strong that it sucked the paint out before it hit the canvas.
Wow.
So painting, I'm like, nothing's happening. It took me a while.
I got to read the instructions on this.
Yeah, and it was like all the paint was going whoosh out the window. Right. So that was a problem. So it was definitely trial and error. And then I discovered the big auto gun. So I have two automotive guns. So actually my husband bought the automotive gun, Andre Yee, who's also an artist, and he was doing flat backgrounds. He just wanted flat matte backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so he bought the car gun. So we have that, and you can spray a huge painting with. Did you ever use one of those?
I think gun? A smaller one. Yeah.
Yeah, I had the big cup.
Right.
That was awesome, but creates a ton of overspray.
Sure.
So now they have a new gun that's in the middle called the Baby. It's literally called the I Want a Baby. So I call it Baby.
How new is the I Want a Baby? Last couple years?
It's only been out a couple years. Yeah, it's a pretty new development. My friend Matthew clued me into the Baby, and it's somewhere in between the small, like,
right.
regular, like, HP brush and the big.
I like that the middle one is called Baby.
I know,
it's kind of
right?
sweet. It's like you like... call your teenage daughter Baby.
Yeah, it should be Adolescent.
yeah.
Gun, but it's not.
Adolescent, it's yeah.
Yeah, so I kind of, it's like the three bears. I got the little bear.
Yeah.
The little bear.
Baby.
So the Baby is then your background sort of coverage?
I background and I block with the Baby. I don't use the big gun anymore. Because right. it was too, I didn't have any control. It was just like,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the Baby is great because it goes from like a maybe 5 or 6 inch spray radius all the way down to like a 2 inch.
Oh, wow. So then the small you're using for kind of finishing, small, even smaller, more delicate touches?
Hairlines. Yeah. Okay. So that's part of the thing, one of the things I do wrong. This is what the coast people don't get. I make, you know, 8 foot paintings with an airbrush that's designed to make 4 inch illustrations or
right.
paint fingernails.
Right, right. right.
Like tiny things. So it takes a long time to make the paintings, I guess. But that's why the mist is so fine, because that mist isn't designed to make big paintings.
Right.
It's designed to make small paintings. So I kind of inverted what the tool was for. And I think that's why the paintings look the way they look. I mean, other than the fact that I'm using kind of the wrong paint and kind of the wrong gun, like wrong in quotes, obviously, because obviously it's right for me. But that's what's nice about tools, though, and that's why I'm hesitant to teach students too much technique, because I think as a teacher, one thing you don't want is a bunch of mini-me's. You don't want a bunch of students who are just recycling your bag of tricks.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really a proponent of technical instruction, but then of, like, learning the rules and breaking the rules, like, that kind
right.
of thing. So
yeah.
I teach them the rules, but I'm like, just learn how to do this, and then you can...
I always think artists with unique, you know, people that weren't artists for a while or have another, like, business background and then become artists, you know, people that didn't have those foundational classes, maybe.
Yeah.
I think there's some interesting stuff happening.
They do some interesting...
like, weird things.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I just read Sharon Loudon's book. Have you read that? Creating and Sustaining a Creative Practice. It's great. It's a bunch of interviews, so you guys would probably like it, but they're text interviews. Although this is not an interview.
Thank you.
right.
It's, and George Stoll's in it. And I don't know if you know George.
I don't, but I know his work. Yeah.
Yeah, and he didn't even go to art school. So I always look at his work, and it's coming from that place, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just being in the art world and looking at art and not having that kind of instruction.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he's a really interesting artist for that reason, the way he thinks about his work and the way he makes his work.
Yeah, yeah. There has been, at various points, this kind of trend of, an artist who is like a scientist, a biologist, you know, and it's like then they have all this cachet because they didn't just go up straight to art school.
Philosophy.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
yeah exactly.
Yeah, right,
exactly.
Right.
So I kind of resent those people for that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But there's also, I think, a fear that comes. I mean, I used to be a graphic designer, and so there, for me, there's like this catch up game. I felt very fearful of my peers for a while, or, you know, like trying to stand up to my peers with my skill set in a graduate school level, you know? And. You just have to own it. You got to embrace it.
And that's very Cranbrook, because Cranbrook admits people based on ideas.
Right.
So there were a couple people we even admitted when I was there who, they weren't like the greatest painters, but they were super interesting people, and their ideas were interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like execution can be learned, you know? Like, if I had my perfect art school, it would be designed so that your ideas were first. So whatever idea the student had, we would... You know, the faculty would look at that idea and say, okay, so you need to learn some woodworking, you need to learn to weld, to execute that idea, you need to learn this. And then it would be like a smorgasbord, and they would just take workshops so that they could realize that idea. So you learn the skill when you need the skill.
Whoa.
Right? Radical.
Radical.
Christian Tedeschi and I really want our own school. So any millionaires out there, billionaires, 1% of the 1% wants to fund my school.
Right, right, right. School of ideas.
Well, if those people happen to be listening, they can also sponsor the show.
Fund the podcast.
So,
that's right.
And my blog. And it'll be great. I'll be so happy.
We'd like your money, please.
Yeah.
But, then I think once you kind of get a thing down, then it switches where your ideas become based on the technique.
Right.
So, you know?
And that's
so,
a trap. That's dangerous.
It can be very dangerous.
And I go through periods in my work where I don't paint. Like, I shoot. Like, I'll go through months sometimes where all I do is photograph and print, and I work digitally. I take things into Photoshop and kind of play with combinations and images and stuff. So I kind of walk away from paint for a little while so that when I come back, I feel like I'm fresh again.
Learning it again in a way.
Yeah, I kind of have to reteach myself a little bit because I find myself doing that too where I get like a thing I do and then I want to do it all the time and I have to stop myself. Oh,
this photo would be so good with this airbrush setting.
I got this, and this like milky paint thing going on, right? I try to like not let myself. Sure. You know, maybe it's my Protestant background. As soon as something becomes too seductive, you have to take it away.
Okay.
That's also a little bit of an art school hangover kind of thing as
Get out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
I really want to talk about, I want to hear about this Art of Conversation. Is it Art of Conversation? What is the exact title? You teach this class?
No, yes. It's Sam's Charm School.
It's Miss Sam's Charm School.
Mrs. It's Miss.
It's Miss.
Because
popular.
You're a feminist.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, if I was really getting into character, I'd be like in a big poofy dress and I'd have a boob.
Miss Sam's Charm School.
I would embrace a whole theatrical performative teaching persona.
Okay.
And is this in the category of art criticism, art
history?
It's a
professional practices class.
Does that mean grad school?
It's undergrads.
Oh.
Yep. I teach some of this stuff to my graduates, too, but most of them kind of get it from me at an earlier point.
Right.
Or I integrate it where I need to in the graduate program.
Right.
But one thing I realized was that the students, when I was writing the class with my collaborator, who's a fellow faculty member, Ron Saito at CSUN, we were tasked with this class, and we were talking about, like, what can't the students do? Like, where are the holes in their education? What are they missing? And so, based on combined, like, I think he's been there 20 years, I've been there 17 years, we just surveyed what was missing. Like, they don't know how to do this. They don't know how to do this. And when we were looking at the list, you know, he told me, he's like, you just want to put all of them through charm school.
Yeah.
Like, that's what you want. And I thought, that is kind of what I want, actually, because the genesis came from when I was teaching a grad class, and the theme for the class was field trips. So for 15 weeks, it was crazy. I've never done it again because it was so exhausting. Every week I took my graduate students on a different field trip. So we went and saw collections.
My God.
So we went and saw Michael and Syria Gold's collection, which is a beautiful collection. And a couple other collectors that I know opened their homes very graciously to us to share their collections. Mm-hmm. We went to artist studios, we went and met with art dealers, and they just got to talk to all these people. And it all started when I was like, you have to send them a thank you note, which Lizzie talked about, and you were a little skeptical of. Michael was a little like, I don't know.
I actually have a funny anecdote about that, which we can get to after you finish your charm school.
To hear it. So
And then Sam can charm you out of your ideas.
I'm going to convince you that you should write a thing. I'm going to write you a thank you note, Mike.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to write Lindsay a thank you note.
Well, she already laid us a nice little spread of
snacks.
Yeah, what's your address?
I think it's like I want people. It's like I believe in being civilized, you know? And I told the students, I'm like, you have to write a thank you note. And some of them didn't really know how to do that. The people who'd been married knew because they had to do it for their wedding, so they like Googled it. So I was like, well, you can't plug your work. I'm like, don't use this as an opportunity, because these are all powerful people. Like, you can't use this as an opportunity to like shill yourself to them, but it should be about what they did for you. And so I was like, think about the experience you had and what stood out of that experience that was really important to you. And so and I said they have to be handmade. So the students, we did it as a project. They made the most beautiful thank you notes for Michael and Syria. And they have this wonderful little dog, and all the students drew their dogs, and one student drew Michael's like distinctive glasses, and they made these really cool.
I bet they loved it.
And so Michael and Syria started getting, I didn't tell Michael and Syria we were doing this. So they started getting all of these thank you notes in the mail. And so I go to check my faculty mailbox, and there's a letter from Michael and Syria, which I still have. And it's this beautiful letter. And they had not opened up their collection to students before. I had to kind of convince them a little bit to do it with the help of Jean Patterson, who was our mutual friend. And they wrote this beautiful letter about getting the thank you notes and how that changed the way they saw their collection and that their collection should be shared. And it was amazing to hear the student response and read about what the students had gotten from the experience.
Wow.
And that now they have a new mission with their collection and to show it to people whenever they can. So I've been back a couple times with my students since then. And now they keep a binder of all the thank you notes. And they have this big book. And every group of students that comes through gets to look through and see all the things that the past students have done. So those notes were so meaningful to them, mm-hmm. you know, that they had had such an impact on these students mm-hmm. that it literally changed the way that they saw their collection. That's powerful. I think, and that's just the written word of someone saying, you did something amazing for me. Thank you.
Yeah.
And so that's my thank you note story.
That's amazing.
So that's where the genesis of this whole teaching students how to make meaningful connections and like, so many students, they're so desperate, and especially because the economy is so bad and jobs are so scarce and it's so difficult, you know, now, much more difficult than when I was young, that they almost are panicked about doing the right thing and, right? To the point where they almost will overlook real human relationships.
Sure.
And so that's what I'm trying to cultivate is this idea that people aren't assets. People are people. And I think feel like thank you notes are a really good tool to help them start to make real connections with people.
Right.
How does social media fit into your
class?
That's
what I was going to ask. Or email.
Like, I do have a social media module from a Sam's Trust.
Okay.
I'm happy to provide you with these supplemental materials if you would like copies.
Well, is that, in your opinion, is that a promotional tool that your students should be using?
So I teach them about social media as marketing. Mm-hmm. But I also teach them how one thing
what not to post.
Yeah, like don't air your grievances, which some of them do, and I have to have like social media interventions with them.
On social media.
Yeah, and just about privacy and what should be private and what shouldn't be private. Yeah. And that, I mean, when people apply to my program, I look them up on Facebook. I look to see. Right? Mm-hmm, like, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
I want to see what I'm getting into.
What do you find out, though? You look at their photos, basically.
Drunk
if,
photos.
Like, if, exactly. If it's like a lot of red cup photos, it's like...
Yeah, too many red solo cups.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but it's a lot of... You can get somebody's sensibility by what they put. And I'm like, all of this is marketing. I mean, and what I'm also trying to teach them about the back end, that Facebook's big data. You know, that this is also, you're getting something, but you're giving something up. So I'm always trying to kind of talk to them about the flip side, because that's one thing that they're not very savvy about. Most of them didn't know the difference between Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always like, Facebook's the people you know, including your mother. I always remind them your mother is on Facebook to behave.
Your mother can see those beer pong photos.
Tumblr's the people you would like to know, and Twitter's the people you don't know.
Yeah.
So those are like three strata.
Is Tumblr, is that a thing these days?
It's been a thing, yeah.
I know I know it's a thing that exists in the world, but it's a...
For art people, is that what you're wondering?
Yeah, so that's a big kind of networking.
Instagram is too, and it's funny, different communities are in different parts of social media. Tumblr's nice. I actually have my students keep a studio Tumblr in my class.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, so they have to keep a studio, and I'm like, this is a professional blog. This is about your practice. It's not about your cat. Mm-hmm. That's what Facebook's for. It's not about...
That goes here.
Yeah, it's not about your vacation. Again, that goes on the Facebook.
Right, right.
I'm like, this is your studio. And so I keep one, too, as an example, and we all follow each other. So I'm trying to kind of teach them how to cultivate a public persona.
Right, right.
Because everything is, you know, what you put into the world is a reflection back on you.
And well, let's go back to the letter thing, because I just was listening to an interview on NPR with this guy who has sort of this whole collection of great letters, you know, between people for grateful things, like a body that was held for this family, you know, from the Lockerbie crash, and the family, you know, wrote this really amazing letter, et cetera, et cetera. So those kinds of stories. And so, I mean, I totally get and am appreciative of the letter, you know, in this email and digital age. But there's still a lingering kind of sentimentality to it. And this goes back to my Lizzie Post anecdote, which is, Lizzie Post, you know, and I did this podcast together. And, you know, I was so happy to have her because she's got, like, such a great voice and is obviously part of this historical lineage of charm or proper communication. And so I sort of, you know, half seriously, half jokingly said that I'm going to send her a card at one point in a conversation, if I remember right. And I did, and I felt a little self-conscious about it. And basically, you know, once the podcast was up, you know, I got a couple of images from her. The podcast was put up. Never heard from her again.
Oh, Lizzie.
So it's like, don't necessarily practice what you preach. You know, for her, this was like yet another sort of pundit opportunity. And then she moved on back to her job or whatever. You know what I mean?
Do you think it's because she, it was sort of a thing where she didn't think that you could necessarily give her any opportunities further? Or was maybe what you're talking about,
I think it's a combination of that and just like, maybe, I don't know. I mean, honestly, there was a thing that we got into that I cut out a little bit of, which was about whether you can approach people, whether it's appropriate to ask people in a certain context, you know, where their support came from.
I remember that question.
And we kind of went off on that on a tangent, which I cut out. And I think she was rubbed the wrong way by my position. Like, in some cases, are you sure it's not okay?
She was
a
little firm in her response.
Exactly.
Yeah, she was like,
exactly. Good memory. So all that to say that I think that part might have rubbed her the wrong way. And so therefore, you know, maybe she was still a little fuming.
I'm charmed that you went out on a limb, though, and sent her a thank you note.
Thank you. Yeah.
So you now
I felt like I did my piece, you know?
It's
you charmed the charmer.
Yes, and you know, a thank you note shouldn't be given with any expectation. So you did the right thing.
I didn't expect a card from her. I just wanted it was great doing a podcast with you.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I really didn't expect a card from her. I just expected that was so great. You know?
But
it was once we actually had the conversation.
Yeah, because it was within the context of this idea of etiquette, right? That you were talking about.
Sure.
And you were like, I'm skeptical, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So at least a thumbs up.
Yeah,
thank you.
Well done, Michael.
Yeah.
So my question is, how does email fit into all of this?
Well, I always tell people, and again, it's like I send thank yous in email all the time. It's like there's a hierarchy of the thank you, right? I don't send thank yous for every studio visit or things. And some things are awkward. Like most critics don't want to hear from you, so you shouldn't probably send them. They're horrified when they hear from artists sometimes, so you should just leave them alone. And
leave
the critics alone so they can do their job.
Unless you want to offer them something really nice.
Yeah.
Well, then they'll be okay.
You want to let them,
Michael?
I always feel like the nice thing to do for critics is allow them to maintain their critical objectivity and distance from you as an artist, right? So even if you're friends with them, I always keep it away from the work, because if they ever write about the work, I don't want to.
Right.
So there's etiquette things like that. That's the tricky kind of stuff that nobody teaches.
Well, you are involved with the visiting artist program at your school.
Yeah.
So some of the people you invite, I presume, are critics and writers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely. I've done that many times.
So does that get a little fuzzy at times?
No, I never talk about myself or my own work when I invite people. And in fact, I do CSU Summer Arts, which is an amazing program. It's a CSU-wide kind of summer program where we're given a budget from the California Lottery, which is why we're still able to do it.
Wow.
Because of the budget crisis. It was set in stone with the formation of the education lottery money. So we're able to do this incredible program.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to invite professionals from the field to come for 2 weeks and work with my students. So it's incredible.
And it's the same students that are there throughout the year. So
it's
undergrad.
Nationwide. Anybody can apply. So it's kind of like an artist residency.
Yeah.
And so I invited David Pagel came, who was great. David's awesome with students first and incredibly generous and lovely. But at one point he was like, aren't you going to show your work? Aren't you going to get up there and show your work? And I was like, it's not my place to do that here.
Yeah.
I'm a coordinator. I was working as an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was funny because he actually asked, aren't you going to? And I was like, well, you can look at my work sometime, but not here.
It's not the
now.
Time and place.
It's not appropriate. So
yeah.
I don't like to use my position.
Way to practice what you preach.
Yeah, I don't like to use my position as a way to.
Yeah.
Did you send him a thank you note?
I do. I think all the artists get, they are thanked by Summer Arts itself.
Yeah.
So are you ready for We'll Call You? Did you come up with a little anecdote?
Oh, yeah. Call You.
Okay, so now it's time for We'll Call You, as in,
we need a
don't
catchy
call
jingle.
Us.
We'll call you.
we'll let you work on that, Lindsay.
I'm going to practice.
So we're gonna give the number out. That number again to leave your Don't Call Us, We'll Call You is 424-256-6618. You can also write to theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. So, Sam, what's your We'll Call You story?
Okay, so I've had so many studio visits. And there's one that I had right when I was making the Storm work, when I started that work, which was a big shift from the animals. Like, the graphic work, I went into this really... I mean, it was like a radical shift. And I remember when I started the work, I was like, this is either going to be the best thing I ever did, or it's going to completely sink my career. And it's curtains. Like, people are going to be like, she's too schizophrenic. We don't want to work with her. And so I was in a little group show as Sabina Lee that a friend curated, and she was supposed to put the animals in it, but instead she put one of the more atmospheric paintings in it, and nobody knew it was me. Like, I was at the opening, and people were like, I thought you were in the show. It was this really awkward thing that happened. But that was how the work got out, right? So people loved this painting that I made, and people started talking about it, and then that's how it happens, right? People are like, start telling dealers, start telling da-da-da, you should come and look at this work, you should come and look at this work. So I started getting hooked up with people. And I got hooked up with Angles. And I love Angles. Mm-hmm. And I love them. They're great guys, and they're really good studio visits. I mean, they spend hours with you talking. Mm. I mean, really getting into the work. Great. Like, they really care about the work. But it was this thing where they came over, and Noel came over a couple times. He really liked the work. We talked about it a long time. He wanted to see everything all the way back to grad school, to pull out all my archives. It was intense. And then he's like, well, we want to come back in a couple months and see more work. So I'd make like 15 more paintings, right? And they would come back. It would be like, this is looking good, da-da-da. Then we'd come back again. So they'd come back again. And then David came over, and he looked for a really long time. And we had a really great conversation. But it was like nothing happened. They never, there was no Will Call You. There was no anything. And then I, you know, was talking to other people, and apparently they're notorious for this. Like, they really take a long time to select an artist to work with. But it was this interesting situation where I never expect something from a studio visit. You know, when someone comes over, it's like...
That's right. A really good attitude.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe they'll do something with you. Maybe they won't. But because they kept coming back, they kept wanting...
It was kind of
this
leading.
Went on for like 8 months.
Wow.
So I was like, well, clearly, they're at least going to put me in the summer show, right? Like, they'll try me out when nobody comes in, right? Right. But it still didn't. So, I mean, they were so great. I still adore that. Like, it was... There were no bad anything, but... But it was kind of this thing where I was just wondering, what's going to happen?
Were they just, I mean, are they just that committed to work that they want to just come look at work and want to talk to you?
They're super serious.
Be around artists.
Yeah, and I think what I have heard from other people, it's that they really don't take artists on lightly. Hmm. They just don't, you know? And it probably would have gone on. And at one point, Noel was like, well, don't show this work. We want to come back again, but just don't show it. Kind of keep it under wraps. Because nobody had seen this work. They'd seen that one painting, but I hadn't shown anything else. And this was all new work. And he said, unless it's too good for you to pass up. He's like, if something comes along and you've got to do it, obviously you're going to do it. But maybe, you know, let's just kind of keep working and we'll come back. And I understand why they were uncertain, because I'd made this crazy shift from these super graphic, like, freaky Disney mutants to these really romantic,
really
not romantic, apocalypse landscape paintings. So, I mean, there's definitely a conceptual umbrella that connects the work, but aesthetically, because I do consider myself a conceptual painter. Like, at some point when I need to use a hard edge, or I need to use impasto, or whatever physical painting process is going to be required for my content to come through, I will stop using the airbrush. You know, that'll happen. Mm-hmm. And so Kim Light came over. So there were other people coming over, and she was the opposite. So Kim Light came in. I don't know if you know her. Do you know her?
I know who she is.
Yeah, but Kim's beautiful. She's like this tall, gorgeous, super stylish woman. Just beautiful. She walks in, and I'm just dazzled by her. I'm like, oh my God, I have a crush on her. You know, like, she's amazing.
Gorgeous.
She breezed into the studio. She walked right in, and she was like, I like that. I like that. I like that. She kind of looked around for a few minutes. She's like, do you want to be in a group show in August or whatever? And I was like, okay.
And you were just under her spell of beauty.
Yeah, and that
forgot
was
what the other
the
guys
exact
said.
Opposite of what had just happened.
Right.
With Angles, who I loved too, and I was kind of like, but it was at that point, her clarity of, like, her quick decision. I'm a quick decision maker. Like, I shop like this, boom, 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 boom. Like, I don't dilly-dally, you know? So I liked that, and I was like, I think... Anyway, it was a great show. It was a really good artist in the show. Maya Lin was in the show. And I thought, this is that opportunity that's too good to pass up, you know? So I was in the show, and I sent Angles an email, like, I'm going to do this. And then after she did the show, she offered me representation. So I took it.
Wow.
And it was great, because I knew that the work that I was making, it was the right time for that work. Because you know how when you make your work, it's like a wave? Mm-hmm. Like surf, not to use a surf, this is corny. You said no cliches, but I'm totally going to do surfing metaphor.
No, cliches are fine. It's just using cliched terms.
Oh, okay.
But you know how, like, you're making the work and you, like, missed it, man. Like, you're either too early or you're too late. That had been the story of my life. Like, the animals I did too early. Like, then all of a sudden that was the thing. And there were all these shows that I'd stopped making them. And then people wanted that work. And I was like, I'm not making it anymore.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah.
And that kept... So this landscape stuff and this, like, apocalyptic weather, like, the Al Gore movie had just come out, An Inconvenient Truth. Like, people were kind of freaking out about global warming. And there was just the moment was ripe, right, for this work to enter discourse and be contextualized within a larger picture outside of art. And so I knew I had to show it. And so when she offered to show it, I was like, I liked her. And I was like, all right, let's do it. So I did it. And that was it. And then when she closed, she referred me to Cliff Benjamin. And I've always loved Western Projects program. Like, I love the diversity of their program. You know, they show so many different kinds of things that come from so many different places. Like, they don't have a look, you know? And that's one thing I really like. So he came over right after I'd done, like, three shows. And I was ready to move on. And I didn't have any... I had all this work, but nothing that I was going to do again, right? And he came over, and it was one of these studio visits where I guess I was just so exhausted. I actually said to him... I was like, listen, here's what I'm thinking, but I'm not going to make any promises. And, you know, we talked for a long time about what I was thinking. And I was like, you probably, you know, don't want to do anything with me because there's nothing. I said, you want to come back? I was like, I'll call you. I reversed it. And I was like, why don't, you know, you can come back in 6 months. Like, I'm not, I haven't figured this out yet. Like, you know, I said, why don't you just, I said, you don't have to feel like you have to. Because it was a referral and, you know, he and Kim were friends. And I was like, I don't want you to feel obligated to share my work. I feel like you don't know what you're going to get with me. I'm like a weird, you know, unknown quantity right now. And you know,
like, we called you yourself in a way.
Yeah, I kind of we called you myself. I was like, you don't have to.
Just
let him off the hook, basically.
Yeah. And he took it?
He called me like 3 days later. He's like, we'd love to work with you.
It's the magic way.
I don't know. Maybe. I think sometimes being honest is a good... Because I was at a point where...
It can also bite you in the ass.
Well, you also don't want to make promises you can't keep. So I don't want to say, I'm going to make this work where I didn't know if I was going to make that work, you know? So I was just really straightforward. Like, it might not be a good time to take me on. Maybe maybe the next stuff's not going to be good. Like, I mean, doesn't every artist feel that? Like, you're starting to feel like, maybe this is going to suck. Yeah. So.
Well, I think the big takeaway is that you were clearly not desperate. You were like, I can wait. I'm in no rush.
Yeah.
And that's, I think... the overriding attitude you want to have in any situation.
And I'm sure they saw that you were just in this exciting kind of momentous time in your, with your art practice, that it was sort of this unknown, but new and exciting terrain.
Yeah. That... He had more faith in me than I did, I think, which was really sweet. So, you know, it was kind of, I was terrified that I was going to disappoint him then because he'd taken this leap of faith. And I thought, oh God, what if I don't deliver? What if the show's terrible? So, and right around that time, so I'd been with the gallery for a while, but I didn't have a show because, you know, I was just coming off all this stuff and I needed time to percolate in the studio and stuff.
Right.
So then I had to move the Santa Fe Art Colony where I lived. Like, the city came in, they're like, we're going to demolish these lofts. We're going to do all this demo. And I was right in the middle of making my first show with them. And we had to move and we bought a house. Like, in the middle of putting up my first solo show with Cliff and Eric, we bought a house and renovated my studio before I could start working. And, you know, he's like, if you want to push the date, we can. I was like, no, I'm not pushing the date. I'm making this work. And I was so stressed out by the move and the studio and going from a big space to a small space. And he's super zen and Aaron's super chill. And they're like, the change of space might change your work. You don't know what's going to happen. Let's just see what happens. So I went into the studio and I just, like, kept working. And I literally, the only way I was able to do that is I went into the studio and I was so nervous about whether or not I was going to make anything decent that I just kind of had a mini breakdown and I was like, fuck it. I'm just going to make the paintings I want to make. And if everybody hates them, fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'll just make more paintings later.
Right. Yeah.
And maybe they'll like those. So I really just hit a point where I literally couldn't worry about it anymore. I hit a wall of worry.
Oh, wow.
And that's when my work opened up.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, so that's when the work, like, I feel like that's when my work got really good, so.
Do you still carry that mentality?
Yes.
Like, fuck it. Fuck
yes.
Opinions.
Totally. I mean, I care if people look at my work and care about it. I mean, obviously, I care about all this.
Sure.
I think that you have to have this, like, delusional hope. Like, that's a term that my friend coined.
Yeah.
Like, that you have to, you have to care and not care at the same time. Like, I always tell people, as an artist, you have to be of two minds. You have to very much care what people think, and you have to also completely not care what mm-hmm. people think. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the art of the studio visit, too, right? Is, of course you care what they think. You wouldn't be there if you didn't. But you also have to, like, remove yourself from that. Hmm. Because if you don't, you will destroy yourself emotionally.
Yeah.
So, you know, because you're vulnerable as an artist all the time. So you develop a really thick skin. So now I do have this very, I just make the paintings, and now I've got this kind of mantra that if I'm looking at an image and I'm thinking it might be really bad, usually that means it's going to be pretty good. So I kind of listen to my opposite voice.
Nice.
Yeah. So when I'm like, ooh, that seems crazy.
Well, Sam, the thank you letter is in the mail.
Oh, wow. You did
I already wrote it. Thank you very much for talking to us.
It was such a pleasure to meet
Thank
you both.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
And?
We're out.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. That is it. Other than the fact that you should check us out on kchungradio.org Sunday, June 1st at 10 p.m. and contribute your Don't Call Us, We'll Call You's 424-256-6618, the Conversation Art Podcast at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I really appreciate your presence here. Spread the word, won't you, about the show? We will get more people and grow this tiny community that is The Conversation. Thank you so much. I will talk to you soon.